like, where is this money coming from? How are you going to pay this? Are my taxpayer dollars going to this? Why?
Hello and welcome to the High Level Showdown, episode 148. Proud members of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. Good evening, everyone. My name is Michael, joined by Elliot and Sharon on this 148th episode.
You went Michael joined, and I thought you were going to go Michael Jordan, and I was like, no, you're not Michael.
No, not quite, not
Hello,
quite.
Hello, Michael.
Yes, I wish. Yeah, quite an icon, but not me.
Not big gambling problem, though. You and him probably have that all. Well, not that you have a gambling problem, but you do like to gamble.
I do? What do you mean?
I thought you like going to play the slots.
I've gone to the casino, yes.
You're the one who has a gambling problem.
I wouldn't say I have a gambling problem.
I went a bit too far with that. Yeah. But you like to gamble, too.
Well, sure. But not to the extent that it's a problem. Anyway, yes, welcome to episode 148. And let's get started in the province of Alberta.
No, before we do that, yeah. We have very exciting news. The live show, episode 150, is booked. December 6th, doors at 7, show at 7:30, the Grislar Cafe on 109th Street between 105th Ave and 106th Ave. We're very excited, and we're very happy and thankful for the Grislar folks for hosting us.
Woo!
So that will be, again, December 6th, doors at 7, show at 7:30. It's booked, ready to go for episode 150.
Yeah.
I think we're all stoked.
Yes.
You'll be seeing some links to a Facebook event for you to, you know, purchase tickets and come on out and have fun with us.
Absolutely. Okay. But before we get to 150, we've got to do 148, of course. So let's start 148. As I said, in the province of Alberta, and of course, contentious issue that has come up before, and that is gay-straight alliances in Alberta schools. And now we get news today on November the 14th that the Minister of Education, David Egan, says, well, if there are schools in Alberta that do not, if public schools in Alberta that do not comply with government regulations around GSAs in schools, then there will be repercussions for those schools. So what do you guys think? Is this an appropriate show of force by the education ministry?
Yes.
Right.
I think it's been a well-managed show of force, actually. Generally, when you take these sorts of aggressive actions, you take this kind of a hard line, you give people who may not like it, who may disagree with it, who may want to push back against it, ample time to either cultivate a position and some public support for that position, or engage in legal disputes, as we'll get into in a little bit, or make a change. And I think that the minister has been clear on this issue basically since day one, maybe since the legislation came out. So that that was pretty relatively early
since
on.
Since they tabled it, this has been very clear. This was last year that this bill was tabled. They had until June 30th, literally, to post a freaking thing on their website saying, hey, you know, this is our policy around GSAs, and theoretically let students form them in their schools.
I mean, there's been a lot of pushback against Catholic school boards across the province who have been sluggish to engage with this. You're speaking specifically to a number of private institutions today, which
so
I think...
So there's 28 of them that
those are the charter schools, correct? Or not necessarily?
They're not necessarily charter. That private is kind of what they're being billed
at. But still get public funded. Dollars and are publicly funded based on the students that they have. It represents about 4,000 students in the province. These schools represent about 4,000 students in this province. So not a majority by any means, but certainly a large cluster of groups. I mean, when I've done my 780 about Covenant Health about like 60 times, I feel like, on this podcast around receiving public dollars and then not following the law. And that was sort of the opening line to Minister Egan's press conference today. Like, if, you know, they need to learn, I have to be clear, following the law is not optional. That's That's sort of the line. So yeah. It is an aggressive stance. That would mean that these schools lose their funding as of the 2018-2019 school year.
Fucking deuces.
But,
honestly.
One thinks that there's more to this than just what's going on, but I've talked a lot already in this, so I'll let you two speak.
Well, I'm just going to say, of course, this is also being said in an election year, right? And if we are to believe that by the next school year, there would be a new provincial government in place, you know, I mean, I guess we said it's a show of force by the ministry, but I suppose for those that this action is targeting, I wonder if they're thinking, well, we're just going to hold off as long as we can because this government won't even be in place by the time.
Yeah, and I think you might be surprised how slow Jason Kenney's government is actually will be to reverse this bill. I don't think that the Kenney government will. I think they'll leave it. I think, you know, there'll be some kind of statement like, you know, not we're just going with this, or like they'll try to avoid it. I don't think these schools are going to see Jason Kenney reversing this.
But even if he doesn't reverse it, would he be would his hypothetical Minister of Education be as forceful as David Eggen is being?
You'd have to look at the actual language of the legislation, and I'm not up on the legislation enough to know this, but you know, you could look at a hypothetical situation where Jason Kenney doesn't change the legislation, but the ministry continues to fund these schools, perhaps through a different funding route or something like that, to the same amount that you would expect they would get under, you know, provincial funding. I don't know if that's a question. I mean, I am disagree with you a bit, Sharon. I think that this would be one of those things that Jason Kenney maybe doesn't necessarily run on doing, but kind of does
but
a smile and nod
back
and will roll
yeah.
back when he becomes
so?
The premier. I think
feel like it would be a very quick way to like really alienate a lot of people who might have been like, oh, well, you know, he's not that bad, or, you know, kind of proving the point of the NDP.
I mean, maybe. We're getting into a huge hypothetical thing.
Yeah.
How many seats does he have?
Yeah,
is it
yeah,
a majority
yeah.
and minority? Obviously, we're probably talking majority territory here. It's also the sort of thing where in the first year or 2 years of a mandate in a government, that's sort of when you pay back all the favors that you promised
perhaps.
In those situations.
But this bill especially was so contentious even within his own caucus, right? There were a number of MLAs or people in his caucus who weren't happy about them, you know, opposing this bill. So I think it might be a little more contentious for him even with, you know, some of the more prominent people in his... I think there's easier wins for him if he goes in, of easier wins that he can roll back. Whereas GSAs might not be something you can touch.
Hey, I wouldn't disagree with you on that. There are definitely easier wins. Do I think that there's a lot of people that are really upset in this upcoming potential caucus that are going to be mad? I mean, a lot of those people have left the party. We've talked about that for a long time. They are, quote-unquote, a big party, and there are, quote-unquote, progressive voices, and we know some of them even in this Edmonton area. How influential those people are once the UC potentially gets shut out of, you know, the center of Edmonton or major swaths of Edmonton, and those more, quote-unquote, big tent PCers or former PCers that stick with the UCP don't win their seats. Those are the sort of hypothetical situations
and
that I'm thinking
of
about.
Of course, it's a social conservatism that the NDP have you know, rightfully jumped on in terms of their attacks on Jason Kenney. So I think this strong showing from the current education ministry and David Eggen, you know, it's part of the NDP's plank of not only promoting themselves, but attacking the UCP. Because, again, we are in an election season.
Has there been any public comment at all from the UCP on this? I mean, we know that they didn't support the bill to begin with. But.
Yeah, no, there hasn't been any public comment. They were kind of forced to comment because actually the Calgary lawyer who's representing the schools and parents and, you know, called for a crackdown on this policy because it was bullying. This weekend, he actually got into a bit of trouble. John Carpe. He also serves as the president of the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedom. And in a speech that he made at a Calgary conference this past weekend, he compared the gay LGBTQ rainbow flag to flags bearing Nazi and communist symbols. And he actually had to you know, retract his statements a little bit and saying that he unintentionally drew a broad comparison, which I'm not sure how you unintentionally have those talking about flags and drawing the comparison.
Does not jive with John Carpe's previous statements in the past either.
So, you know, so they actually, the UCP had to, you know, comment inadvertently around this issue because this, obviously having the same guy who's defending the school's right to not have GSAs, you know, compared the two. So they haven't had an official statement, but it's interesting how, again, sort of these kind of, you know, they call it radical or weirdos or freaks who are, you know, don't really align with their views, apparently, always crop up and, you know, mess with the UCP's brand, I guess you'd say.
Can I be really cynical?
Yeah.
Like, really cynical? Sure. Can you guys tell me if I'm being too cynical?
Okay.
Do you think previous to the controversy this weekend with John Carpe, David Akin makes this announcement today on Wednesday? After the controversy that went on over the Remembrance Day long weekend, do you think he comes out? Because they knew full well that these schools are represented legally by John Carpe. Do you think this is a planned or scheduled event ahead of time?
No, actually, Elliot, I don't think you are. I think there's something to be said about political opportunism and, you know, not to say that this is because of those comments made by Carpe, but...
I'm not saying that it is because of that, but yes, it could be.
And I don't think I don't think you're wrong to assume that, Elliot.
I don't know. It could be little bit cynical, but I'm not sure. I'd like to also know the event that John Carpe was speaking at was a Rebel Media event.
Yeah.
So, you know.
The organizer of which said that if Jason Kenney did kick him out of the party, there'd be 600 members of the Rebel Media Alliance that would be also removing their membership of the UCP.
Great.
No, I do think it's interesting. The reason why I'm cynical about this and why I bring this up is because he mentioned specifically private schools and specifically and those private schools who have joined together and are represented by John Carpe. He didn't talk about the Catholic schools. Not that I know
because they are compliant already. So he
are they all? Because there was a question that there was.
So they have a firm list of the schools that now. So a lot of people did drag their feet. A lot of schools.
School boards, as opposed to schools.
School boards and the individual schools. So they've released a list of all the schools that are not compliant, or you know the media obtained them, of course. So yeah. So Catholic schools are not. There's no Catholic schools on this. What the fuck is Universal Educational Institute of Canada?
Well, there is some Christian schools.
Yeah, there is a lot of Christian schools on here. I think this, again, not to drag this on for too long, but this brings up the whole idea of should our public taxpayer dollars be going to fund, I know you touched on it a little, Elliot, religious institutions, faith-based institutions. When we talk about, you know, this, Elliot's banging his head. It's same as our hospitals. You know, I just think I do not like that my money goes to funding private schools. And if they are funding private schools, then private schools should abide by the law of the land. That is just simple as fact. If the government of Canada says assisted suicides are legal, then fucking Covenant Health should be able to assisted suicide. If the government of Alberta says GSAs, but if you're funded, you should have GSA
policy. Don't you know, Sharon, that they are governed by a law higher than that of man?
Oh my God. Well, I hope that God gives them the money to run their
institution. Divine revelation.
And not the government.
Let's not conflate two issues here, though. Okay. There's also two other sides of this. Yeah, Covenant Health and Catholic school boards, should they even be publicly funded at all, is a great question and a major piece of this as well. This goes a step further. These are private institutions, elitist institutions. Okay, let's not get that deep
into
it. Well,
the many fees of them to be able to go to these schools are
many
thousands
of them.
And
yes,
thousands
yes,
of dollars
yes.
for
there,
many
there,
of them.
There's an accessibility question around this as well, too, that are also getting government dollars to... That's another issue below this as well.
Totally.
Outside of the fact that obviously they're not here.
How come I am paying for something that I couldn't even send my own kids to? That's some bullshit.
That's right. That's a very so let's not conflate those two because those are two separate issues.
Yeah.
I mean the Catholic Covenant Health or Catholic school boards. they are still public institutions, and they still operate. They operate as public institutions, faith-based public institutions, and they should also adhere to the rules, I will add. But and there are issue people I know that take issue with even them getting funding. Me less so, as long as they're following the rules. Because honestly, a lot of those institutions, those public school boards, those private healthcare, or those public religious-based healthcare institutions, are the backbone of this province. You know, Red Deer doesn't have a hospital unless the Catholics, in the formation of the province of Alberta, set up a hospital there to treat rural injuries and things like that. The same with many, you know, Mundare doesn't have a schoolhouse unless, there's a Catholic board that sort of governs that as well, too. Those are institutions that are part of Alberta's history, and it's a different conversation. But when you're talking about publicly funded dollars going into private institutions, that is where I draw the line and where I take big issue with. And yeah. I think, you know, when we talk about America a lot on this podcast, like every week, basically. Yeah. And one of the things you've seen in America, I truly believe, is the degradation of a public school system across the country because they favor private institutions. And that has hurt low income and particularly people of color, because they don't have access to the same levels of education because they can't get into private schools. Their parents can't afford private schools. Yeah. And education is a human right, is a basic human right. It's something that Amen. Everyone should have access to. And you shouldn't be tiering education. And if you are, then you shouldn't be getting public funding for it at all.
Preach, Elliot. Well said.
Guys, if you haven't checked out the Well Endowed podcast by the Edmonton Community Foundation, you are missing out. But never fear. This latest episode, episode number 32, called Artists and Analytics, is one, a great one to start with. On this episode, Brian Jackson, Director of Data for Good, tells us all about Edmonton Arts Datathon 2018. And then they talk about the renowned Pro Choro Canada Choir, who are about to start a new endowment fund they've created to honor two outstanding volunteers. Guys, check out this podcast. It's one of the best, the wellendowedpodcast.com.
Okay, so we're going now, we're staying in Alberta, and we're going to, of course, we are based in Edmonton, so let's talk about Edmonton's provincial rival, Calgary. And Calgary.
Go Oilers!
Yes.
Hi, Sharon's family.
So, of course, Calgary was in the headlines recently, last few weeks, actually, because of a proposed bid that's been floating around about Calgary hosting the 2026 Winter Olympics. Now, of course, Calgary famously hosted the Winter Olympics 30 years ago in 1988. And so the idea sprung forward that, well, Calgary should host the Olympics again, of course, a time of great prestige for the city. Or is it? And so the debate about whether or not to actually host the Olympics in Calgary actually got pretty heated in the city. And so Calgary City Council
punted.
Yeah, well, they, you know, and Elliot has many times on this show railed against the use of referendums, plebiscites, but Calgary City Council, as he says, you know, gave the word to the people of Calgary. We're going to have a referendum on whether or not you want us to proceed with a bid. Of course, this is not saying that Calgary would get the Olympics. It's just to make a bid to the mm-hmm. International Olympic Committee. Do you, citizens of Calgary, do you want us to proceed with a bid for the Olympics? Do you want the Olympics to come to Calgary? So the vote was held yesterday, November the 13th, and around 57% said no, and 43% said yes. So that was around 300,000 voters mm-hmm. in Calgary that voted, so a 30% voter turnout. So again, 57% said no, we do not want Calgary to host the Olympics. 43% said yes. So who would have thought that the Olympics, the Olympics about sports, right, could be such a political thing? But yet the Olympics are very political, and here we saw it. So I mentioned the word prestige. So for the yes camp, it's yes, let's bring the honor of the Olympics to Calgary. But for the no camp, the side which obviously won, it's not about prestige. It's obviously about economic viability and all that. So a very interesting chapter. What do you think? I'll start with Sharon because I know she has roots in Calgary. What do you think of the, you know, the argument of prestige, the honor of the Olympics versus sustainability? Is it worth it to do something like the Olympics?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I felt very removed from it being in Edmonton, but the different camps and the different sides. So I think a lot of things led to, you know, the demise of this bid. First of all, I think, you know, not to use this really overused word right now or phrase, economic anxiety. With the way the economy is, obviously we know Calgary was hit really hard by the recession and still paying for it. I think a lot of people, it made them very nervous for that much money to be going to an Olympic bid. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people were like, where is this money coming from? How are you going to pay this? Are my taxpayer dollars going to this? Why? And then it was interesting to see the kind of tug of war going on between the different levels of government, because there was a lot of hesitation for any level of the government, federal, provincial, yeah, and municipal, to fund this Olympics. The Calgary, there were a lot of councillors who were not for this, and they said, you know, we're not going to put money on the table if the federal government or the provincial government aren't going to put money on the table. I think it was actually Rachel Notley's government that first announced they were giving money, then Ottawa, I think, or maybe that was reversed, and then lastly, then Calgary was like, okay, this is how much money we're putting forward. But it was only in the last couple of months, actually. And so I think for a lot of people, there was a lot of unanswered questions. And, you know, the Yes side did a lot of great work to try to, you know, bring people around. But it begs the question, do people really care about Olympics in the same way that they did? I love watching the Olympics, but in terms of hosting them, because of the things that we've seen in the news, the corruption of the IOC, how much money Olympics cost and drain, you know,
I think actually that is the key point. We can all enjoy the Olympics as long as somebody else foots the bill.
Which, right? I don't know if so, that's necessarily
But again, it's one thing to watch and send your athletes and bring home a haul of medals. It's another thing to host it, right? And of course, history, we learn from history. And in Canada, we have had the Olympics in Montreal, 1972, were notorious for leading to a massive deficit for the city of Montreal that they only recently paid off.
Right? Yeah, I mean, I think that's a huge piece of it as well, too. But I think there's more to the decision than that. I mean, the economic one is a big one. And some of the pushback around that, too, was that there seemed to be a commitment for the federal government, the provincial government, picking up half the bill. Then they said they weren't going to. They said they'd never committed to that. So there was lots of sort of upheaval around how much every level of government was actually going to be contributing. But let's not forget that there are lots of people who don't really support the IOC, who believe it's a corrupt organization, who think that they're money-grubbing, awful institutions and don't want to support it. There's also a great group of people who stand up there and look at what happens to marginalized and poor populations in Olympic host cities, saw what happened in Vancouver in 2010, and are not going to support it on that moral ground as well, too. I think that there's more than just an economic pushback as to why you wouldn't want to support this type of event and why you wouldn't want to push this forward. Frankly, I think it's hilarious because I think that there would have been...
Oh, that's hilarious.
There was a point in this process when Edmonton was looking very hard at engaging in the same thing. And actually, had a plan of pushing forward a joint bid with Edmonton and Calgary. It would have mean a shared cost agreement, which would have been beneficial, much cheaper for both cities.
What events would Edmonton
potentially
have?
Be beneficial? Well, we have an NHL hockey arena.
Yeah,
we
fair.
Could do, you know,
curling.
If they
curling,
a
speed skating arena. You'd have to build some sort of infrastructure too. You'd also have to engage with probably a third partner city. In some
ways, they would have had
to
do that anyway because they didn't have.
I think they mentioned Jasper too.
Were actually thinking about Whistler for the ski jumping
so across two provinces.
So you start looking at a bigger thing. But Canada's also a big country, and we're starting to realize that this is a huge event to host. So across a number of different jurisdictions, seems to make much more sense, if any sense at all, that the Olympics.
But then, what do you
to
say
do as well too?
Alberta, BC, 2020, Canada, 2026. I don't know.
I mean, whatever. We could work on the branding later. Anyway, that all blew up in flames when Calgary gave Edmonton the middle finger. And
is that what they did? Is this just an Edmonton?
So you know what? They stay fucked in, and I don't care. We had an opportunity to help you out, Calgary, and you're like, Stephen Carter and the rest of you are all like, no, Calgary's going to do this all the same, and you got rejected. And, well, that's how it is. Let's talk about plebiscites for a second here.
Yes, well, let's talk about
absolutely
that.
Absolutely.
What about
me? It was kind of funny. Like, I was talking to my friend yesterday. I was like, oh my God, like, I guess I didn't realize that they were, everyone had to go to the polls. I'm like, this is like fucking Brexit or something.
We're not going
to
do it on a Twitter poll.
I know, it's just funny. And I was like, obviously it's not as like huge as Brexit, but like, you know, it is really hilarious to me that this is like what happened. Couldn't they do an online something?
Well, no, I agree with Elliot. This is,
come on.
I mean, okay, so I agree with Elliot. I think a vote is serious, and
okay,
and you know, it warranted a poll.
No, it doesn't warrant.
No. But I'm saying because a referendum was called, then it warrants being done properly.
Yeah, well, do you think a referendum should have been called for this?
I hate referendums.
Should qualified people have looked at the numbers but then and looked at the pros and cons and made a decision?
I think so.
That's exactly how all policy should be made. That's exactly how you're elected to be a policy wonk, to engage and think about critically about things and govern by your ideology and what you think is right. You don't put it to the vote of the people.
City Council said that this referendum was non-binding, which means that they could theoretically...
Oh, that's BS. They were never...
Of course they won't, but theoretically... They can discount the results of this.
It is political cowardice to engage in any type of plebiscite behavior.
Ooh. Well, that's a little far. I don't agree with that.
Political cowardice. If you truly believe in what you believe in, then you have the ovaries or the balls to be an elected official, and then punt when push comes to shove on a difficult policy issue to the electorate, to be governed by special interest and people that can put more money into this bid or into this process, then you have no business sitting at that table in the first place. That's your role as an elected official.
If we had a referendum in this city, then you're saying that you wouldn't participate. You wouldn't vote in a referendum.
Well, I wouldn't participate. It's not that I wouldn't participate. I wouldn't support the idea of going to a referendum. I'd either have a position no or a position yes.
Well,
I would expect the people that I elected to have that capacity to do that. That's their job.
I think that there are times.
This is the
making. I don't know if I completely agree with you, but I do.
I
like the sounds of what you're saying.
I would say the same. Your sentiment is not wrong, Elliot, but I think there are instances when referendums are valid ways of voting. So for your complete demonization, I think a little too far. But
I mean, you just have people with more money and more special interests engaging in this thing. Look at what happened in Brexit. You had a group of people who were the least impacted by the outcomes of Brexit making that determination because they showed up, because they were mobilized, because they were easy. It was easy to demonize the other, and old, rich, white people get scared easily, and that's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
That's your role. How can you
in this particular though? And it's also interesting, of course.
I kind of liked it in every
referendum that we said was the will of the people, but I guess with any election too, you know. But not everybody shows. No, but I'm saying it depends who shows up.
300,000 people,
right? So that's also interesting. Why do you think Calgarians, where many of them didn't even know what was going on? How come more people didn't show up to vote for an Olympic bid in this case?
I mean, most people don't show up to vote.
Yeah.
Okay. We're lucky to get 50%, sometimes 60% in a really close race or one that's really controversial. I mean, those are the sorts of things that, like, you know, you engage people. But, you know, ultimately, when you're talking about democracy, there is it's a mess. And people don't show up. And then you end up with people having a disproportionate amount of say. I mean, this is what frustrates me about this. This leads to situations where you have people calling for plebiscites on everything that they don't agree about, and they don't agree with, they don't think is right. And it just, you know what? I have a lot more time and respect for a politician that puts out an idea that's not popular and works to make people understand why they think it's good policy than anyone who defers to the electoral population on a specific policy.
Well, there's an argument that they elected you for a reason, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Well, I mean,
this
I wonder...
This is the greatest hits here for me, eh? Like, Catholic institutions being funded
for sure.
And referendums.
I love it. Well, you know, it might be a goodbye to the Olympics for Canada, but I know in 2026 I will be watching wherever it is, and maybe we'll get Olympics.
But we are
Sunday.
Getting the World Cup, no?
Yes,
right.
And, yes, yeah. We are.
And FIFA, if anything, is way more corrupt than IOC.
Than IOC. Yep. But so, that you know, that spread over a number of cities as well. So
and politicians just did their job and made a decision whether it was right or wrong. That's their role.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, I personally feel you're a little extremist, Elliot, but
he is
certainly
extremist. So, Michael, you posed this question before the show started, and we didn't answer because we thought we'd save it for the show. So, if you guys had voted today, if you were a Calgarian, how would you have voted?
I would have voted no.
Why?
Well, for me... personally, I you know, as we said, it's one thing to enjoy the Olympics. I think footing the bill is something completely different. And you know, I think it's a if funds and spending are not obviously conducted responsibly, then we see how easy it is to balloon into debt and deficit. And so that would economics would be top of mind for me. And so that's why I would have voted no. I think obviously any Olympics are expensive, and again, looking at past models, there is reason to be skeptical and to, you know, guess be discouraged. And again, not because you want to kill the Olympic spirit, but you just want to be practical. So I would have voted no.
Sharon?
Ooh, I actually am very torn on this because, again, I freaking love the Olympics so much. I think based on, like, a lot of the information that I read, and I didn't read a ton again because it's, like, you know, it doesn't affect me right now, I think that the Calgary 2026 committee did a lot of great work to show how this was going to be cost-effective and what they would do. So I think I probably would have voted yes.
Interesting. I have had the fortunate experience of actually living in Vancouver in 2010 during the Olympics, and they are certainly one of a kind. I'll never forget the experience of being there and how special it was being the host country, all these people from around the world, seeing athletes around, being in athletes' village, going to Canada House, all those things. I still would have voted no because...
Brag.
Yeah, I still would have voted no. And I vote no for a number of reasons. I think economically, Michael, you make a good point, but it's not the major reason why for me. I think these major events, as I mentioned before,
social
are very, very problematic for marginalized and poor groups in their host cities. And I am a big believer in voting with your dollar. As I've gotten older, I've stuck to that as a principle of mine moving forward. And I don't think that we should be supporting the IOC in any way, shape, or form. I don't think it's a credible organization. I don't think it's an organization for good. I think it's wrapped up in corporate bullshit and not right. And I think they take advantage of amateur athletes. I have a bunch of different issues around this. So I would be voting no.
Yeah. So we'll see then. I think there is Sweden, I believe, and a joint bid between Milan and another country. So there's two European contenders left for 2026. So we'll see. Apparently, Salt Lake City is also being courted by the IOC.
And they also had an Olympic before as well.
That's right, in 2002. So let the Americans do it.
Oh,
they can always.
At Romney's Town. We're proud members of the Alberta Podcast Network, and we're excited to introduce the latest affiliated podcast, Let's Do Coffee. Let's Do Coffee is an extension of the excellent work done by the Mowaji Center for New Venture and Student Entrepreneurship at NAIT. So every entrepreneur has a story to tell, lessons learned and wisdom earned, and in Let's Do Coffee, they talk to different entrepreneurs who are doing incredible work. So in the first episode, Ashif Mwaji, the center's namesake and the founder of Upside Software, talks to the host, a NAIT student, about how he started his company and gives valuable advice for all entrepreneurs and anyone who's interested in this type of thing. So if you'd like to learn more about this, visit the albertapodcastnetwork.com, and that is Let's Do Coffee.
Okay, so let's just go straight to the United States, and it is that time of the show again. Ladies and gentlemen, It is
Trump Watch.
Yes. So 2 weeks now after the midterm elections,
yay,
a new
in which the Democrats won with a big blue wave.
It was more of a drizzle.
It was a wave. Okay. They won Arizona. The first bisexual female, gay female, LGBTQ female senator won. It was a blue wave.
Okay, so
they're taking back Florida.
Okay.
So many people might be asking, you know, now that the midterms
only 49% of white women voted for the Republican. I'm just kidding. Come on, it is an improvement, Sharon.
Yeah, they did better. I mean, although, okay, this is not to digress, but someone today in a podcast I was listening is like, okay, we're always talking about the white women, guilty, me, and, you know, people who didn't come out to vote, but the group we never talk about are the, all the white men who still overwhelmingly came out in support of Trump. So
look,
both of you, look at yourself in the mirror and think about what your people are doing.
Yeah. We know for a long time white men are bad, okay?
Maybe that's why we don't talk about it. It's like there's no hope for them. They're gone. Okay, so midterms are almost over. I mean, some votes are still going to be counted in a couple of states.
Because there was a blue wave and there were so many votes.
All right, okay. And so a lot of people are thinking, what now? So what's going to happen? And it's almost the end of the year, but there's still some big things that are happening in Congress before, you know, these new people come into power and come into office. And so the White House actually has 7 small funding bills right now waiting to be approved, mostly because in March, Trump said, I'm never going to pass a big spending package again for whatever reason. Anyway, and so in these last few months where the Republicans have, you know, still have that control and there's, you know, a lot of that ground made, the big question is, like, we need to pass something. And a few things are going to happen is what the word on the street is that one, the Democrats are like, okay, yeah, we'll pass your funding bills, but we want some protections from Mueller. You know, this Russia thing is ramping up. We have this new attorney general. We don't want this guy to be in danger. And the big thing that Trump wants to be funded before December 7th is border.
Mm.
Trump needs to build this wall because he knows if the House is taken over by the Democrats, once
which it was in a blue wave,
okay,
which
yes, yeah, when it is, when they come into office
in January,
they will, the border and the wall is going to be in big jeopardy. Mm-hmm. So guys, what do you think about this? Do you think that the Democrats will, you know, give up, you know, say yes to the border wall or some kind of money to immigration or border security to be able to protect Mueller? What do you think is the right move here?
Yeah, well, I guess it's what I would think that Mueller is a huge weapon in the arsenal against Donald Trump. So I would think that to protect them would be a high priority.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, I think, you know, by blocking a wall, sure, that is opposing Donald Trump, but in a way, is it not also helping him? Because he will, as he has obviously done in the past, well, the Dems are blocking my agenda. You know, it's not my fault. He's very good at deflecting blame or culpability. And so if the wall is stalled, well, it's the Democrats' fault. It's not my fault. And that will further serve to, of course, incite his base. And I think Mueller is a bigger weapon to be used, a bigger weapon that should be protected if you're against Donald Trump.
I mean, I think Mueller is pretty much in big trouble as it is right now, and I don't know that there's necessarily a bill that can even save him. I mean, a bill that protects his job, okay. We've seen how the Trump administration plans on dealing with Mueller, and that's by appointing a new attorney general, even though it's a temporary one, a new attorney general after Jeff Sessions left, and now systematically cutting his budget is what we expect will happen and will continue to happen. And that will mean less lawyers on his staff. It will also mean how public that final report that he creates, how widely that's spread. I mean, you imagine it would leak, but you never know in these sorts of situations. Yes, what I'm saying sounds ridiculous, but Donald Trump and his administration are playing with the strings of democracy, and the institutions that have upheld in the United States for its entire history. And they're doing it in a very tyrannical way, in a way in which we haven't seen maybe ever, but certainly since the Nixon administration. So is the Mueller investigation the thing you need to hang your hat on? I think it's important, but I mean, a lot of the stuff that Mueller's doing, a House investigative committee could be doing anyway, and the Democrats have won the House and have that power now. They have subpoena power now. I do think giving Donald Trump a win on the wall is probably better than heading into a situation where the government shuts down, because the Democrats will always be blamed for the government shutting down in this situation. I think the president, any president, the party of the president always has sort of an incumbent advantage, an inherent advantage. We saw it when the government got shut down earlier this year. And I think that, you know, what we'll see is if it were to be shut down again, the public narrative will be slanted against the Democrats, which is not what they want going into their new Congress, where they are the representative, the majority in the House of Representatives. That's sort of my that's my political speak. It's not what I think in my heart, but it's my political speak.
So a couple things. I think it'll probably come down to dollars, and so I think Republicans want, you know, $5 billion for border security. Democrats are like, I think we're willing to give $1.5 billion or whatever it is, which is, you know, still crazy. But my question is, does, you know, investing more money in border security and signaling, okay, we're, you know, working on this issue with the Republicans, does that help the Democrats' base? In terms of, you know, you had these very controversial and huge issues this year with, you know, the kids in internment camps on the border. You have this caravan thing. Would, you know, this whole splashy headlines like, ooh, Donald Trump gets extra money for his wall, you know, the Democrats helped, you know, make this happen. Does that hurt them with the people who, you know, obviously don't support, you know, investing more money in ICE or border security or anything like that?
I mean, I don't know. I think there's one of the things that we learned.
Is it a risk that they should take?
I mean, it's a good question. One of the things that we learned, I think, 2 weeks ago, is that the Democrats have to be all things to all people at times in order to win elections. There were really progressive politicians who took really progressive positions
and won.
Not as many as I think we would have liked in more moderate or purple or even red states. I mean, Andrew Gillum is really the one exception I can think of.
Yeah.
But he didn't win, or hasn't won yet anyway. So there is sort of, you're kind of going back to this, like, where do you put the line? Because I think that you're right, Sharon. I think there is a new wave of young, diverse Democrats who have engaged in this political process, who believe in some sort of change, and change needs to come from a multitude of different elected officials, that would be very disappointed in that type of loss. There's also a group of pragmatic Democrats that are like, look, this is just what we need to do, because if we shut down the wall over immigrants again, Donald Trump's just going to smoke us and we're going to have no momentum or be really undercut heading into our time in majority, when we're actually going to be able to make a lot of different change, potentially, right? I mean, that's sort of the back and forth around.
And it's not funding the whole wall, right? It's only, you know, quote-unquote tightening border security. But this is definitely a must for Trump. So Trump wants to run on the wall. He wants to run in 2020 that I built this wall, because build that wall was the
although he
whole
did say
chant,
Mexicans
right?
were going to pay for it.
Well, building that wall and immigration is again going to be a big thing of his campaign. He wants to run on the wall. He wants to say, look, you know, this wall is coming up. This is what I've done. And so I think the wall might be the most, besides, you know, Mueller or whatever, this whole wall is going to be one of the most contentious issues and the biggest sticking points for Donald Trump as he goes into the latter half of his presidency. Mm-hmm. And I think Democrats need to be very careful on how they play this, because I agree with you, Elliot, that they don't want to be seen as, you know, obstructive to government. But I also think if they're able to undermine Trump in his wall and those things like that, it could help them when it comes to 2020.
Yeah, I know. I mean, really, he's had a few legislative victories, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't think, you know, like a great record
no,
of look
all.
What I've done. So, yes, I think you're right, Cheryl. I mean, the wall
they
is
failed on healthcare.
It's a huge badge for him, yeah.
They failed on some of the major things, like, yeah. you know. So I
and
think
you saw the challenge to the country ban,
yeah.
right? Muslim ban.
His successes politically have been regulatory and by provincial proclamation.
Nothing
I mean,
big,
there's the
no
well,
things.
The tax cut. The big tax
yeah.
cut was the big thing, and
yeah.
that's what they ran on. And
but also
unpopular.
For the average person,
no.
though, that tax cut is not going to resonate as a
Absolutely
big win
because
it doesn't actually benefit them.
No, I completely agree with you. But that,
yeah.
that's what they're going to hang their hat on as their big political success, right?
Yeah.
Paul Ryan got his tax cut and left.
Yeah.
So I do think... You know, I think you're right. I mean, I think it's an incredibly, you know, we talked about this right after the Olympics, or the Olympics, the election, which is our Olympics, as Michael
That's
often
right.
says.
Yeah, yeah.
yes,
I do say that.
That we're headed into a very divisive time. And I think one of the challenges around divisive politics is
yeah.
that it's negative and it's nasty. It's also incredibly difficult political minutiae to negotiate, and when you've got a new crop of young progressives who are in there to make a difference and make a change, because that's what they ran on and that's what they saw as the core of the blue wave that they just won on. I don't know how many times I'm going to say blue wave in this segment. That
well, waves
is
are typically
challenge.
Blue, Elliot. You know.
Yeah, that's true.
So.
That's
oh,
true.
My God.
That's true.
You did an interesting...
What's the opposite of progress?
Yeah, Congress. Yeah. You can laugh. You're just ashamed that you couldn't
sorry,
get it.
I'm
sorry, too.
Started,
I'm sorry, too.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry that you guys couldn't get it. I'm very sorry.
All right, all right, all right.
How do you think this goes? If you guys are going to make a prediction...
Oh.
Yeah, I think there's going to be some funding
for the wall.
Yeah.
So if Sharon said Republicans are looking for 5, Democrats are hoping for 1.5, where do you think it lands?
It's 2. It's 2 a middle number.
Low.
Yeah, it is.
That's low.
But I mean the Democrats would fund
3?
It, but it's not,
I think it's like 4, 4.5.
You think?
That's almost,
wow!
Because I think they'll push
much?
It. I think they'll push it to the deadline, and Donald Trump will send another $5,000 troops to the border. He'll start talking about the caravan again. It'll get people all worked up. He'll be doing something ridiculous, and then he'll be able. And it's enough for him to claim victory. So, and that's all he really cares about.
Yeah, of course.
And dividing America.
It's about ratings and winning, right? Not Charlie Sheen. Remember when he was saying, I'm winning? No, it's Donald Trump. It's all about winning. Yeah, that's for sure.
I had a friend who got into like the top 20 of when he did that competition online to be his social media advisor right after he like had that whole
winning. Oh, Charlie Sheen.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was interesting. Hmm. Let's just go to the 780s this week.
As opposed to what? Like what?
That's how we always
As opposed to continuing on this very brutal, awful subject.
Okay. So, Elliot, what's your 780?
I don't have a 780 this week.
Yes.
I have to say, you're never prepared.
I never.
What is,
I don't understand.
What is wrong with
you?
You
know it's coming. You know it's coming. You know it's done every episode.
I always have one midweek and then I forget it. And then I get in this.
Why don't you write something down? What's wrong with you?
I don't know.
See, and I'm always the opposite. I have several that I could choose from.
Oh, wow. You're so.
Okay, I will do a 780. I will do a 780.
Well, you have to.
I'm so glad in us talking there, you figured it out.
Yes. So this weekend, I finished the third season on Netflix of Daredevil, which I really enjoyed, thoroughly enjoyed. It was a great episode. That show is really good. The first season's amazing. Second season, it's okay. The third season, not as good as the first, but pretty good. It's worth watching just for the Kingpin character. There you go. There's my 7.
Okay, actually, that's great, Elliot. Mine goes
oh,
off
I know
of yours.
What it's gonna be.
Yes, mine goes
I
off.
I thought of you this week, actually. I was like, I bet this is going to be Michael's 780.
Yes, so as Elliot mentioned, Daredevil and Kingpin, and those are two Marvel characters that were created by Stan Lee. Of course,
Pour one out for the homie.
The visionary Marvel genius Stan Lee, who died this week at 95. So, yes, a great, great old age.
I just poured out water all over my bed.
You're supposed to pour it on the floor, Elliot.
I think, you know, we use the term genius. It's been used often, but only
Is he a very stable genius?
Yes, he was. He certainly was. I think, Elliot, but there's only a certain.
He would have thought that was.
I think so. But I say there's only a certain number of people who actually do warrant the title genius. Yes. And Stan Lee's creativity, Spider-Man, of course, Daredevil.
Spider-Man's my favorite.
I think he's the most popular, right? Yeah, Spider-Man, Hulk, the X-Men, the Daredevil, Ant-Man, and of course those superheroes and Iron Man. Those superheroes also have their villains, right? So the Green Goblin, Kingpin, as Elliot mentioned, right?
Scorpio, Dr. Octopus.
That's right. Mysterio, Electro. So a very...
Electro's in the Daredevil, by the way.
Is he? Oh, that's cool. Electro, I got to check it out, yeah. A very fertile mind. Stan Lee was a literary genius who elevated the art form of comic books. It wasn't just... you know, kids' literature. Yeah. It was sophisticated.
Yeah, totally.
And
yeah.
I mean, when you look at all the blockbuster films in the last little while, what are they, superhero movies? He's had such a mark on culture and art in our society, for sure. Yeah.
So,
and always had the impactful. Best cameos.
Yes, they're very fun. Yeah.
So Excelsior, so Stan Lee, and rest in peace wherever you may be.
Great. So my 780 goes to a podcast that I just binge listened to. And I'm kind of late on this. So shout out to one of our listeners, Laurel, who actually recommended this to me. I love a good cult story, if anyone knows me. And this one is called Escaping Nexium. And Nexium is spelled N-X-I-V-M. And it's about a cult. And the main person who escaped the cult, who it's centered around, is actually a Canadian. So it's the one that's produced by CBC. It's super fascinating and really just shows you, again, what happens when people get caught up in a certain kind of dogma. But it's so interesting, so fascinating. Really recommend Escaping Nexium. You'll be hooked from the beginning. There's all kinds of things that happen, like sex and branding.
Elliot's favorite thing.
Sex and branding.
Sex, branding, like, you know, secret societies within a cult. Like, all the classic cult things. Like, it's really fascinating, but also, of course, very sad, as these are people's lives, you know, that are affected by, you know, something pretty intense. So, really recommend, if you listen to the podcast, tweet at me. It's so good. Go listen to it. It's Escaping Nexium.
There's a really popular cult in Edmonton.
Oh, yeah.
Integrated Philosophy.
We should
Johnny
do
Johnny Reuter. Not to be confused with John Ryder.
Yes. No relation to me or my husband. Oh, yeah. So, maybe we'll do a podcast in the future on the College of Inter-something... whatever it's
College of Integrated Philosophy, or also where Sharon and John met. Sharon, where can people find you on Twitter?
You can find me at SharonMVU.
I'm at MaestroMichael2.
I am at Tantyegg. We are at High Level Show on Twitter. December 6th, The Grizzlar, 7:30 to 9. Be there or be square. Until next time, bye everyone.
Good night.